So klingt Weihnachten bei Rewe. Jetzt festlich sparen bei deinem Weihnachtseinkauf. Diese Woche bei Rewe. Meine Lieblinge, Wildlachs in Scheiben, je 80 Gramm Packung oder Lachs in Scheiben, je 100 Gramm Packung, nur 3,29 Euro. Oder Le Rustique Camembert, französischer Weichkäse, je 250 Gramm Packung, nur 2,79 Euro. Festlich sparen bei Rewe. Dein Markt.
The Axe of the Blood God.
Welcome to another episode of Axe of the Blood God, US Gamer's official RPG podcast. I'm your host, Kat Bailey. With me today is, as always, my lovely co-host, Nadia Oxford.
Hello, it's good to have you back. You must be so cultured now since being in Europe.
Also with me today is US Gamer's newest edition, who started, it's about a week ago now, a week and a half ago, 2 weeks. Katie McCarthy, who is our new reviews editor. Welcome aboard.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Welcome to the Axe of the Blood God, where blood spills daily.
Yes, as always on this podcast, we talk about RPGs in all other forms because we love the genre so very much, Western, Japanese. But I do know that you are a fan of The Witcher, Witcher 3, right, Katie?
Yeah, I'm a huge fan. It's probably one of my favorite games now, like playing it a bunch, but... You know, I always think I should wait a few years before I declare it as one of my favorite games ever, but I do really love Witcher 3.
It's funny because I think I was pretty down on The Witcher 3, actually, on this podcast.
I think you were.
Yeah, I was a little bit down on it because I don't know, for whatever reason, I was never able to feel it, but I could really appreciate just what a kind of an amazing sort of construction it was, like how well put together it was, how gorgeous it was, how interesting the various combat moments were and that sort of thing. So I could appreciate it kind of from afar, even if it left me a little bit cold. But I think that I've said this on the podcast before, I'm much more of a mechanics person. And Katie, you're much more of a story person, am I right?
Somewhat. I feel like they kind of have to work together. Like, I feel like The Witcher 3, like, sure, the fighting isn't that great in it, but it also requires more strategy. Like, you have to make sure you have, like, the right oils and the right potions, and you have to, like, really prep before you, like, go into a fight. So, in a way, it kind of feels more strategic than most, like, action RPGs, where it's just like, yeah, you just run in there and hack and slash stuff.
Yeah, we're kind of the same mind in the kind of the idea of how mechanics and gameplay systems can impact the actual story and reflect the story. Is that kind of fair to say?
Yeah, totally. I definitely agree with that.
Nadia, of course, is much more on the story side of things in general. Like, Dragon Quest... Dragon Quest ultimately, like, that's like pure story right there.
Yeah, pretty much. And Dragon Quest is really unique in that the story itself is simple, like its mechanics, but again, like the mechanics, it's so compelling in its simplicity. It just kind of takes that one idea and polishes it to a T. Even story-wise, I was talking to Bob Mackie on Twitter the other day about how...
Bob Mackie?
Do we not say his name anymore? No, he's cool.
No, we totally see him.
Yeah, but he was saying how he was playing Dragon Quest VII and a certain story moment happened and it was really, really dark. And I said, yeah, when Dragon Quest decides to get dark, it does not screw around.
No. Same with Persona 4, which we will be talking about in a little bit. Katie's on Team Persona 3.
Yes, so that's a team I haven't experienced yet.
So this is going to be pretty interesting. Also, it was interesting. It's kind of important to get Katie's outlook because we're going to be talking about Horizon Zero Dawn, which she reviewed.
I'm sure you haven't heard anything about
controversy.
Nothing
at all. Like, just nope. Totally not controversial at all.
It's just sad.
And we will finish up with a discussion of my current run through Chrono Trigger, which I was gushing about ridiculously on the website. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to that. Like, a nice little bit of, happiness and light after our discussion of Horizon Zero Dawn.
Except for the whole end of the world
before
thing.
Before that, let's get to our Persona 4 Golden Report. Persona! And I guess this is a special Persona 3 version of our Persona 4 Golden Report. Katie, when I first met you, I said, Katie, what is your, like, one of your favorite games of all time? And she said, well, I love Persona 3. And I was like, ooh, interesting answer. Not Persona 4. And why was it Persona 3, Katie?
Well, I think that Persona 3 is a lot darker. And, I mean, Persona 4 is dark because it's a Shin Megami Tensei game. But I think 3, thematically, is all about death and, like, the consequences of death. And I've always found that really interesting. And I just like the characters in 3 a lot more than 4. Like, I found most of the people in 4 really annoying.
No.
So it's kind of like...
Nani's going to start crying. Don't do that to her.
I don't hate 4. I still think 4 is a great game. It's one of the greatest RPGs ever made. And arguably, I feel like it's probably a better game than 3. But I do love 3 more, just personally, I guess.
I can appreciate that viewpoint, because just certain games, even if they're mechanically inferior, they're sometimes they just have that special spark that really drives it home for you.
Mm-hmm. It occupies a special place in your heart, and that is totally okay. Nadia, like, some of the differences, like, between Persona 3 and Persona 4, I mean, like, in a basic structural level, it's quite similar, actually. You have a... a silent protagonist coming into a new school. In this case, it's more of an urban setting than in Persona 4, which is, like, a lot more rural.
Yeah.
But instead of having people get, you know, thrown into televisions, there's a kind of like a midnight hour, or like a period of time, a dark hour, where, right, like, everybody disappears into coffins or something. And
cool.
Those who don't disappear into coffins kind of get attacked by these shadows.
Mm-hmm. So it's very much the same idea.
Somewhat, yes. But also, there's a tower called the Tartarus where the school should be.
Right.
And your goal is to get to the top of the Tartarus. And a lot of what is driving kind of the central mystery of Persona 3 is what is on the top of that tower.
Right. So it's kind of the same structure where you have that central mystery and the game revolves around solving it.
A little bit. Persona 4, you know, like, it's a whodunit, right?
Exactly.
Like, you're going. But it also puts a ton of this really, really supernatural aspect into Persona 4. Where Persona 3, it puts a much heavier emphasis on the supernatural part.
Right.
And Katie, like, kind of correct me if I'm wrong, but I sort of feel like the kind of one of the central themes is destiny, where, like, you're hurtling toward a fate, maybe a bad fate that you can't stop. You can only kind of inexorably continue to move toward it. Am I wrong in kind of remembering that?
No, I totally see that in Persona 3. And I think because... In 4, like, your main dungeon kind of changes throughout the game, whereas 3, it's pretty much always the Tartarus. Like, you're always climbing that Tartarus, and it gets kind of repetitive in that way because every floor basically kind of looks the same, and
right,
you just kind of face bosses as you progress. But, and it's also, like, the kind of, like, end of the world thing. Like, that's always kind of, like, the main thing you're trying not to let happen, which is such a typical JRPG thing. Like, oh, you don't want the world to end, but... Yeah, I definitely see destiny as a primary theme with 3. Whereas with 4, it's just like, who's this murderer? Let's figure it out.
And that's interesting about the Tartarus in 3, because one of the things I really like about 4 is how different the dungeons are. I mean, I just went through the Void Dungeon, which is based around a retro game. And I thought that was a lot of fun.
Okay, so really quickly, Nadia, like, where exactly are you in the game?
Well, as I said, I did the Void Dungeon, which was based around, like, a Dragon Quest game, sort of, so of course I liked it. But I caught someone who says they're the killer, but probably is not, because the game is maybe halfway over at this point, so I'm guessing there's a little more to it than that. He sure looks creepy, don't get me wrong, he looks like he's capable of killing a few people, but he also seems like the kind of person who says, oh yeah, I did it, because he's really lonely and wants attention. So... yeah, that's where I am for now. Also, I cooked omelets. I cooked omelets and it went really badly for everybody, especially Nanako, because she had to eat them all.
Stop cooking, Nadia. Oh my god. Katie, have you ever watched Buffy the Vampire Slayer?
I have not.
I recommend that you watch it because it's really good. And the reason that I bring it up is that it's actually pretty similar to Persona 4, in that you could almost say that it's like a combination of like Persona 3 and Persona 4, in that you have characters who are kind of railroaded into doing something that they don't necessarily want to do in supernatural forces, again, in the context of supernatural forces, which is kind of Persona 3-ish, but also puts a big focus on, you know, Buffy the Vampire Slayer is just mostly a metaphor for being in high school, right? Like, high school is hell. That is like the central thesis of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And Persona 4 and Persona 3 are very similar in that regard, in that it is all about growing up. It's all about like the relationships that you make. I think, in my opinion, maybe Persona 4 handles the latter aspect better. Like, I know that you were saying, Katie, that you didn't particularly like the characters of Persona 4, but I suppose that I felt the bonds between all the different characters a lot more strongly than in Persona 3, where characters like, I can't remember who the main character is, the perfect girl who's like in charge of the student council and everything. Like, they almost feel, they don't feel like real people. They feel like kind of like anime characters, like even more so than usual. Like, you have the silver haired guy who's like kind of a boxer, and then you have the perfect student council president, you have a dog, and you have a robot. And
the it's dog's like, okay,
yeah. I mean, this is, it's like a fun cast, but it doesn't ring quite as true as Persona 4.
Yeah, I guess like I can see that criticism, but I feel like I can deflect that back onto 4. Like, Yukiko is just the typical shy.
Hey, don't talk shit about my waifu here.
I really don't like Yukiko.
No. Aww. She's so sweet.
How can you not like Yukiko? She's great.
She's just like, I've seen her in so many, like, I've just seen that character so many times. I'm just bored of it. I don't know. Like, I really like Rize, and then, like, there's other characters that I don't hate. I mean, I don't really like Teddy either. I find Teddy really annoying. So,
I like how fishy he is. He's so cute in his human form.
Yeah, he's super cute. I wish he was just that and not a bear, but, you know.
Well, his name is Teddy.
Yeah, it's true.
What speaks to you about the Persona 3 cast in particular, Katie?
I like how boring the main character is. He's just like a blank slate, and then or importable, or like, you know, you can play as a girl, and then I don't know, I just feel like the central trio of, god, I can't remember any names right now, and this is terrible.
But Junpei Iori.
Yeah, I really like Junpei as like the annoying sidekick guy. Like, I feel like he's annoying in a good way where you don't hate him. He's just like very endearing. Whereas, is it Yosuke? Yeah, I don't really like him, so it's kind of like, maybe it's just like a bias of like not, I don't know. It's just, I didn't feel like I grew really attached to 4, even though maybe they go through more as like a team, as like, you know, they're like an investigation team, they're like trying to solve these crimes, whereas in 3 it's like, we're just climbing this tower. So it's like, the build to that bond is probably more present in 4, but I think I just enjoy the social links of 3 more.
Yeah, Persona 3 has a more of an apocalyptic feel to it as well.
Yeah.
You were mentioning that you're always trying to save the world, and like the kind of the apocalypse has always been a kind of a central theme of Shin Megami Tensei, like going back to the very beginning of the series. So in that case, in that sense, it's maybe a little more faithful to the kind of the core of the series, and like Persona 4 kind of spins off in a different direction where strictly speaking, the world is never in danger to my recollection.
It's mostly about Inaba.
Yeah, right. It's like making sure that the killer does not get away with what they are doing. So in that sense, I suppose like the stakes of Persona 3 feel a lot greater. But you know, there are like so many different there's so many different stories about the apocalypse and like the end of the world and destiny and everything.
Yeah.
That it's sort of refreshing to me to have kind of a supernatural whodunit in Persona 4.
Yeah, I agree, because as you say, apocalyptic stories are a dime a dozen, and especially in JRPGs. But as someone who grew up in the city, there's something really interesting about seeing a small town fall apart because of these horrible murders that no one can really get to the bottom of. And that's just like something you don't see very much in video games.
Yeah, and I think that it was a bit novel for me because, I mean, I lived in Japan, but I never spent that much time in kind of a small town.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it was a really different perspective
exactly.
for me. Like, I was like, oh, like, it's not just like hanging out in Tokyo or whatever. Like, here is a small town and this is what like life there is kind of like. And I think you really, it does a really good job of conveying kind of the close-knit community.
Right.
And how things like, you know, Juness can come in there and like and totally just upend everything.
And just kind of destroy everyone's small businesses. Because I was talking to you in a previous episode about that. I wasn't sure about what the situation was in Japan about like how big retail affects smaller mm-hmm. retail. And so that was really interesting for me.
Now, the good news is you don't have to choose which game you play. You can play both of them.
You're kidding me.
Both Persona 3 and Persona 4 and Persona 1 and 2, if that's kind of your jam, though they are very different games from Persona 3. Kay, did you ever play 1 and 2?
I've always wanted to, but I've heard since they're so different, I'm wondering if it's worth it to play them or if it'll be a thing where I just bounce off of it really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I know that there are people who are going to tell you that, yeah, you should absolutely play Persona 1 and 2 and that they prefer them to Persona 3 and 4. I think that's a taste thing. Persona 1 and 2, I found maybe a little too dated, but like I said, there are people who are hardcore RPG fans who like really don't give a crap about how dated a game particularly looks.
Yeah.
It's a matter of taste. Like, I like the style of Persona 3 and 4, especially 4 Golden. I mean, Katie, you're a designer. Like, you can, like, kind of appreciate, like, how gorgeous Persona 4 Golden is from, like, a design standpoint, right?
Yeah, totally. I think that's one of the reasons why I've always been drawn to the Persona series is there's, like, a design element there that's really not present in most, like, not just JRPGs, but just, like, games in general.
Yeah, it's like a very stylish game. Stylish series.
Yeah, super stylish.
Like, even the menus have so much effort put into every single command.
Exactly.
Yeah, and that's, like, doubly the case with Persona 5. Like, it almost hurts how gorgeous that game is. Like, it's almost too much. I'm really interested to see how that bears up over the course of, like, 100 hours.
Yeah. All these color choices. Why did you do this?
Katie, like, having played Persona 3, which one do you recommend? Would you recommend Fez or would you recommend Persona 3 Portable?
That's such a hard thing. I like how you have the option to play as a girl in Portable and you have more agency over your characters because, like, in Fez, it's, like, automated except for your character, which is, like, a bad thing, in my opinion. And 4 changes that, obviously. And then Portable changes that, too. But also, I feel like it's more visual novel-y, in a way. It's not, you're not, like, walking around the environments as much in Portable. So you're kind of losing that aspect of it. And I feel like, I don't know, I'd probably recommend Fez over Portable. Even though Portable also has plus sides to it, but
I thought that I wouldn't care about losing the ability to actually walk around because in the end of the day, like, you're still just kind of navigating a menu, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I was surprised how disconnected it made me feel from the town.
Yeah, totally.
And the people, because it was a point and click game all of a sudden. Like, I am of the mind that it is the best way to experience Persona 3, but it's not perfect, which is why I've been like going, come on, give me a Persona 3 HD for God's sake, please.
I'd play that.
God, like, I would be happy to revisit it. If anything, I feel like Persona 4 has gotten a ton of traction over the past few years, because that's been the one that's been kind of the most accessible and the most modern, where Persona 3 has fallen back a little bit because, well, the best version you're going to get is probably Persona 3 Portable. And a lot of people don't seem to even realize that you can get that on your Vita.
Yeah.
We will continue our discussion of Persona 4 Golden next week, but it's interesting to have a Persona 3 proponent on the staff, because I sort of feel like Persona 3 has fallen away a little bit. Like, even people I knew who are like 100% Persona 3 for a long time, like, have kind of gone over to Persona 4. Have you kind of perceived that, Katie?
Definitely. I feel like back when I first played Persona 3, there was a lot of fans for it, but then 4 came out, and I feel like everyone was just like, yeah, 4 is better. Which, I mean, technically, I think it is, but I don't know. It's a weird thing. I feel like people only really care about 4 and kind of forget about 3.
Yeah, I remember when everyone was talking about 3, and it just seemed to fall into a ditch once 4 came out.
Mm-hmm. And it was pretty soon after, too, so it's kind of like 3 got left to the wayside pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So my standpoint, and maybe this was because I had people who argued really hotly for 3, was that 3 came out, like, it had a ton of fans, like, that was when Persona and SMT really sort of kind of started to become a thing here in the US.
Yeah, definitely. I would say that.
And then Persona 4 came out, like, not long after. Like, it came out in 2008. And the people who really enjoyed 3, like at least the ones that I knew, were like, this game's too yellow. Like, that is literally the criticism that I heard. And, you know, like, in fairness, like, all of the yellow is a bit distracting at first.
Yeah, there is a lot of yellow.
There is a lot of yellow in that game. And then, and, like, I remember, like, the first time I played Persona 4 being like, oh, like, the structure doesn't work as well as 3. Like, I prefer the structure of 3. And to some extent, I still do. But then Persona 4 Golden came out, and that was when everybody kind of flipped.
Mm-hmm.
At least that was my perspective. But in any case, you go to Japan, there's Persona 4 stuff everywhere and no Persona 3 things at all.
Aw.
Yeah, super true.
Poor Persona 3. But it is nice to have an advocate for the game on the staff. But yeah, let's keep going. All right, let's get to the main topic. Our Horizon Zero Dawn review. As many people know, Katie reviewed Horizon Zero Dawn, and she gave it a pretty low score. So one thing that I want to address is that US Gamer has a 5-star system, and we do not take Metacritic into account when we are scoring our games. And I encouraged Katie to use the entirety of the scale, and she did. She was kind of underwhelmed by Horizon Zero Dawn, and I, having played it some myself, I can actually pretty much agree with her perspective. Horizon Zero Dawn is certainly a technical marvel. It's gorgeous. But I feel like it's really shallow. And I think that is a thing that really carries on through the entirety of it. And the fact that not only does it never really grow beyond kind of the beginning, it seems to actually get worse. Like, is it fair to say, Katie, that, like, the back half of the game really drags Horizon Zero Dawn down?
Definitely. I feel like 15 hours in, I was kind of expecting it to wind down. Like, you have, like, this big revelation in the story, which I'm embargoed from talking about. But yeah,
there's a ton of embargo stuff on that so game. It's kind of ridiculous.
Like, writing a review is really hard because I had to dance around all these things I could not talk about. But yeah, it hits this, and then it hits this point, and then it kind of plateaus entirely. Like, not just, like, in terms of story, but in terms of mission variety and everything. It's just like, okay, I'm doing the same thing for, like, 15 more hours. And at that point, you're already at a point where you can pretty much have the third tier. Because there's 3 tiers of weapons you can have. There's, I think, Nora, which is, like, the weakest or whatever. And then, I think, Karja and then Shadow Karja, which is, like, very rare. It's, like, a purple color-coded thing. So, basically, at that point in the game, you have all these really strong weapons, and there's not really any sense of progression in terms of leveling up. Like, when you level up, your health meter goes up, and that's really it. So it's like, you already have all the strongest weapons, you're already at a point where you, like, think, okay, I'm as strong as I can be, I'm, like, very OP, like, I'm taking down things with, like, not a thought, and then you're just doing the same thing for 15 more hours, and it's a huge bummer.
Yeah, there were a lot of people who were like, well, why aren't you talking more about the, like, the actual kind of strategy to it? And, like, initially, there is strategy, right? Like, I suppose there's a bit where, like, you're using traps to take down enemies, but it feels like that really falls away into the back half of the game, where, like, you're able to, like, really just kind of roll things without, like, much problem, and you no longer have to even really use any of the tactics that are actually available to you.
Yeah, like, so there's pretty much two weapons I use throughout the whole game. There's, like, a trip caster, which is, like, you set a trip mine, basically, where if an enemy's running towards you, you just shoot that really quick, and it will trip over it, and then its weaknesses will be exposed. And one of the first abilities I maxed out was this, like, you zoom in and, like, time slows down a bit, so it's kind of like a slow zoom, and then you can max that out, so you have, like, a few seconds, like, a pretty long time to be able to, like, fling arrows at people, or things and robots. And when you go into your focus mode, which is kind of like your Batman detective mode, like, everything that's weak is, like, bright yellow. So you basically just, you zoom in really for a long time, you shoot all their weaknesses, they fall off, blah, blah, blah. And it's just, like, there's not really any strategy to it, because it's, like, I have, like, I maxed out this ability, so I have so much time to take down this thing. And, yeah.
Yeah, they were really kind of at pains to, I suppose, limit the RPG-ishness of Horizon Zero Dawn, which I should say that that's not a good thing or a bad thing. It's a thing, like, that developers are doing. They like to co-opt RPG elements to give it kind of a veneer of death and depth. But in the case of Horizon Zero Dawn, it's like, oh, yeah, you have, like, loot, and it's different colors. You have skill trees-ish. But, like, we really go out of our way to, like, for example, hide the stats.
Oh, really?
And make them, like, really, like, you can kind of see stats a little bit. I think there's a elemental aspect to the game. Am I right, Katie?
Yeah, there's, like, some enemies that are weak to, like, fire or, like, ice things. And then you have, like, different arrows or, like, bombs and traps and stuff that can, like, expose those weaknesses. But yeah, I don't think that comes into play too often. Like, in most cases, you can kind of, you're just strong enough and you can just kill them anyways. So
yeah, the actual open world has, you know, a lot of kind of the cliches of open world design. Like, again, maybe not good or bad, like collecting stuff and crafting. It's a thing. It's, like, reasonably well executed, but I can see, like, why people would start to think that, feel like that's a tiny bit cliche. But even if, like, you are like, what, I'm totally on board with this, like, whatever, like, collecting things and crafting things, that's awesome. I don't think that it necessarily just adds to the game. I think, like, it's kind of a neutral thing, right? It's like, okay, you are using the thing that everybody uses when you're creating this game. That's fine, whatever. It, I suppose, is a fairly competently executed open world game, if, like, pretty linear, right?
It's hard to call it linear, but there's, it holds your hand a lot, and I feel like the main missions are definitely linear, whereas, like, I mean, the open world itself is just, like, typical open world stuff from getting to and from places, but it's a lot of, like, they throw you into, like, a boss fight where you're in a big arena, and you run in a circle, and you set traps, or you set trips, and then you shoot things, or it's, like, okay, I have to take out everyone in this, like, very small room. And it's just, it's weird because, like, the rest of the game is not really like that, except for the main missions, which just, like, put you in these really, like, linear situations.
Let's talk really quickly about a thing that I found really interesting about your review, which was kind of the motivation of the main character. And you were of the opinion that they did not do a great job of figuring out what the motivations of Aloy should actually be, and that that kind of comes into play in the side quests, in the respect of you're trying to figure out like why exactly she would be taking on these side quests outside of, well, it's a video game, so I guess she should be doing that.
Yeah, I've mentioned this like in I think a hyperlink because I don't want to like I've always hesitated to like straight up call out another game in my review because like I don't think it's really fair to compare it to another game, but Horizon was reminding me so much of things The Witcher 3 was doing really well, which is it creates a purpose for the reason why you're doing all these side missions. It's like you're a Witcher, you're doing a job still, and Aloy's on this big quest to, like, find the answers. I'm trying to speak very vaguely. Just, like, trying to find the answers to, like, things. And it just didn't make... There's not really a reason for her to go helping out all these random people. Especially because she was so bitter from her childhood, which is established in, like, the first hour of, like... She was, like, alienated as a kid. Like, literally a kid. And people were really terrible to her because she was, like, quote-unquote an outcast. But things happen. And then she gets over it. For no reason, except for like a few instances where she randomly gets really angry again, and it's just really weird. I'm like, where was this the whole game? Like, you've been totally fine, but now you're mad again. Yeah. It's like really weird.
I'm kind of interested in your perspective on this as well as Nadia. Like, well, at what point does the narrative have to justify the mechanics? I wonder. Like, is it okay just to be like to kind of take things at face value and go, well, an RPG should have side quests, and I don't really necessarily care about the motivations of the character. I'm just going to do the side quests. Like, I accept that there are some, like, mechanical concessions to be made.
I am definitely the kind of person who's easygoing when it comes to those concessions. Although, it's a lot easier when your protagonist is kind of a silent cipher to begin with, and it doesn't sound like Aloy is that at all, so that is kind of strange. I can see where Katie is coming from. What really kind of makes me curious about this whole game, I haven't played it at all, but and I still plan to, but it just sounds like a perfectly pleasant open-world game, no problem with that, but I just don't understand, like, what it is that is making everyone, all the other reviewers, go completely gaga about it instead of just giving it like, oh, 7, 8, you know, go on their merry way. I haven't really nailed that down yet from any of the reviews I've read.
I mean, it's pretty.
Oh, it is very, very pretty. Very pretty.
Yeah, it's pretty. It's safe. I don't know. Another thing about, like, Aloy's, like, character motivations is I feel like the game and the story and whatnot, like, positions, like, her story so strongly, like, and I can't really talk about why, I guess, but, and that's, I think, why it bothered me so much, like, the lack of, like, they made the story so important in this game, but they didn't really take the time to, like, craft Aloy as a character, or,
right,
like, make her motivations, like, feel, like, worthwhile outside of the core narrative, so...
Yeah, because it's like, if you have Link or the Dragonborn, it's just like, you know, you gotta save the world, and it's like, okay, I can accept that, but if you
yeah,
have,
exactly.
If you have a character who's supposed to be developed, and have motivations, and have, you know, as you say, things she's irritated about because of the way she was treated as a child, that's a little different. You have to really kind of follow up on that.
Yeah.
I find that aspect really interesting, and, like, I've been trying to think of, like, other RPGs, like, with side quests and things, where, like, for example, like, this would be a problem. And, like, I was thinking about, like, Mass Effect.
Mm-hmm.
And Mass Effect, you know, it kind of makes sense, right? Because you're, well, I mean, in a lot of cases, like, you're going and trying to, like, in the case of Mass Effect 2, you're trying to recruit people to your cause.
Right.
And you're, like, flying from planet to planet, and you're getting, like, strange readings on your sensors, and you, like, want to go check them out, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's a reason for you to be doing this thing. And as you were saying, Katie, Witcher 3, it's your job.
Yeah.
So I've never actually, like, given some thought about, like, the motivations for taking on side quests. And I'm really interested to go back to, like, some other RPGs and think about, like, how mechanical like a construct that actually is, that you're like suddenly taking on random jobs for people. Which is a thing that goes back to like the freaking beginning of history, the beginning of RPG history, because it was like, it was a D&D thing, right?
Yeah.
The thing with Horizon Zero Dawn that at the end of the day gave me the most pause was when you were saying that you're fighting the same boss like multiple times, like four times. And yeah. I was just like, oh God, no, not that. Oh God, it's the worst thing.
It's so bad. It's like the same, it's just this really big machine. And every time you face it, there's something new. It's like, oh no, it walks this time. Oh no.
Look
it's
out.
Like, yeah, it's okay.
Yeah, that was pretty, I have to say, that was pretty terrible in Skyward Sword when you had to fight that big stupid brown thing. Like 50 times, it was awful.
Oh no, that thing again. Ah, God, you're giving me PTSD now.
Flashbacks.
I think that Horizon Zero Dawn might have this a typical problem that you see in a lot of like these big AAA kind of epics, mm-hmm. in that it starts out fairly well, but then towards the back half of the game, you start to see a lot of padding, mm-hmm. because they're like, well, let's be honest, like these really big development teams, like they only have a certain amount of time to craft like this all of these incredible assets and everything, and it's really tough to just like carry things forward through 30 hours or more of like this beautiful game,
right?
And at some point you got to wrap it up, right? And so that is why you often see like a lot of AAA games kind of not having the best endings. And when they do have a really good like finale, it's almost a surprise. One of the things that like that's what kind of makes Witcher 3 stand out, right? Like that it is so consistent in its quality over the course of such a long time. Mm-hmm. Horizon Zero Dawn has, well, frankly, like what Katie was saying, like it plays it really, really safe. And mm-hmm. like the people I was talking to, like people are going, yeah, I think Sony is going to be like really in for a surprise, like with how this comes out. Like I'd say it's a solid 8 out of 10 in terms of like maybe like it's a very safe open world game, but then like people are like really outsized in their praise. I was surprised. I was pretty surprised with how glowing the reviews were. So Horizon Zero Dawn, everybody.
Let's give it a round of applause.
Katie was like, it's not really an RPG. Do we have to talk about this?
It really is hardly an RPG. So
like you were saying, it's kind of like Far Cry, but maybe without the really interesting freedom afforded by Far Cry. Yeah. Like some people were comparing it to like a Ubisoft game, kind of Assassin's Creed-ish. I feel like maybe it pulls down a lot of the tropes that we've come to see in your fairly standard AAA open world action game. Mm-hmm. I think the thing that initially attracted me the most was it had robot dinosaurs. Like that was the most interesting thing.
Yeah, and that's
about
a pretty
it.
Big selling point, I have to say.
Yeah. And I was like, well, I mean, it's fairly fun to play to fight against these things. Which is why like it was a drag to me to find out that the enemy variety kind of ran out later in the game.
That's
and
true.
That the encounters become a lot more repetitive and a lot less interesting, and that the tactics fall away, and that you're able to like basically roll through so much. And I'm like, oh, yeah. Really? Oh, man. Like, so I was hoping for a much more tactically interesting game, or just an interesting game in general, like from a mechanical standpoint, than what we ultimately got. And I guess my impression of a game that like is gorgeous but ultimately kind of shallow like is gonna bear up. But Katie, thanks for weathering the storm.
Yes, thank you for enduring all that.
But Katie McCarthy, we can read more of your work over on US Gamer, and I would recommend people check out your little bit that you wrote like on the first couple days that you were there about Yakuza 0 and food.
Yeah, I really enjoyed writing that. Because I was playing Yakuza 0 before I got the job, and I hadn't been able to write about it, so I'm glad I got the opportunity to.
everybody seems to love Yakuza 0 because there are so many GIFs out there now of the main character, like, just throwing people through windows or, like, just generally being crazy. It's actually pretty amazing.
Yeah, I haven't been able to play it myself, but I've watched my husband play it a bit.
We haven't talked about it on the podcast, so, like, give us your 30-second recommendation of Yakuza 0.
It's really good. It's like nothing else I've ever played. I played a bit of 5, but I like 0 a lot more because this is a game that, like, really acknowledges how weird side missions can be and makes them worthwhile and really fun and all really unique and varied. And the main story, the core story and drama is really good, and it gets pretty crazy. And that's my recommendation, I guess.
All right, then. Katie McCarthy, we will talk to you later.
All right. See ya.
And we're back. Thanks to Katie McCarthy for coming on and talking about Horizon Zero Dawn. Apologies for not going super in-depth into the story, but unfortunately, we really can't because, like, Sony's, like, so stringent on embargoes. But so it goes. I think the biggest shame about this whole thing is, like, how obsessed people are with Outliers.
That's what struck me. I don't want to say weird because I've seen this before, but it's like I said in the comments of the story itself, that it's funny, the day that the review landed, I had just seen The Founder, which was a really good movie about Ray Kroc, the franchisee of McDonald's. And I really liked the movie, and most people really liked the movie, but then I just happened to stumble across the review by The Guardian, and they really didn't like it. But it didn't really register. It's like, oh, okay, well, here's one guy who didn't like the movie. Big deal. Life goes on. But of course, you don't pay, like, hundreds of dollars to go see a movie, so maybe that's it.
I'm sort of like, I think the thing that has really, like, stuck with me is, like, one of the reasons I hired Katie was because, like, I really liked her voice, and I really liked that she had interesting opinions on things, and I really liked that she backed up those with opinions with really nuanced analysis.
Yes.
And that's, like, a thing that I like to have on the site. Like,
it's good to have.
I was like, yes, this is, like, the voice that I want US Gamer to have, like, really smart, critical reviews. And, like, if this has shown me anything, like, maybe there's no room for that in this space. Like, maybe, like, it doesn't matter what you write or what you say. Like, if you give the game, quote-unquote, the wrong review, like, the wrong score, you're just going to get murdered. Well, like, I read Katie's review, and I was like, I can't see this as being lower. I can't see this being higher than a 3.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, it was a pretty scathing review, and I mostly agreed with it. And I'm like, oh, okay. Like, having played it, I was like, oh, well, that's too bad, but I guess it is a 2.5.
Yeah.
But, of course, it's an outlier, and everybody else was like, everybody else who was on Metacritic was super positive on it. And I'm like, okay, whatever. So we have a different opinion, but you can't have a different opinion in games. That is not allowed.
No, apparently not. And but, you know, you kind of may as well, as I say, you're hung for a lamb, same as a sheep. But because even if you give a game, like, a really high score, and maybe not everyone gives the game a high score, you're going to get accused of being in the publisher's pocket. So there's really no winning from losing.
No, there absolutely isn't. And I've been doing this for a little while now, and I remember, like, reviewing Halo 4 and going, huh, that wasn't very good. And, like, the people I talked to were going, oh, that was all right. And I'm like, oh, this game's not going to get very good reviews. And then it got, like, freaking nines and tens across the boards and A's. And I'm like going, what? Like, these super glowing reviews. And I really could not figure it out. And I gave it a pretty, like, I remember I gave it a middling review for Shaq News, but because we didn't score it, like, nobody noticed or cared.
Yeah, yeah.
And, like, and now in hindsight, all the fanboys are like, oh, Halo 4, meh, don't like it. Same goes for, like, Skyward Sword. Like, I really am not looking forward to any Zelda review ever, because there's literally no way that you can give it lower than a 4.5, because like if you do, like here come the trolls, like here they're kicking down your door. I gave Skyward Sword like a 4 out of 5 on GamePro.
Mm-hmm.
And oh my god,
you would have
thought I had killed like somebody's like newborn child. And even my friend back in Minnesota goes, well, you can't give a Zelda game like a B. Come on, it's Zelda.
Well, look at Jeff Gertzman's 8.8 still lives in infamy.
8.8.
That was for Twilight Princess, if I'm not mistaken. To this day, I still say to my husband, 8.8, never forget.
8.8 was too high.
I like Twilight Princess. And
you know what? I like Twilight Princess. 8 out of 10 is a good score.
Yeah, 8 out of 10 is a great score. I think 8.8 is pretty suitable.
I think it goes to show that review scores don't mean anything anymore because they've been so inflated.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people just aren't willing to use the entirety of the review scale because the mindset is Metacritic. Metacritic has set the score. And, like, for as much as people complain about the so-called 7 to 10, like, if you go outside of that,
you'll people... You'll get death threats.
You get death threats.
Actual death threats.
People lose their mind. I'm not going to lie. This has been a really disheartening experience for me. I don't know. Like, I've always known that this is like the case with gamers, but man, did it really drive it home. So
it was also kind of a perfect storm because, as you say, it was a console exclusive and everyone said, this game is great. And Katie said, it's not that great. And so it was like, you know, stone the heretic, you know?
Biggest console exclusive of a generation. Like, I feel like everybody was rooting for it to succeed. And I think it's going to succeed. It's going to sell like gangbusters. It's going to get a sequel. I mean, what do people want? It's gorgeous.
That is kind of it. What do people want? One thing I remember from actually when I used to read GamePro is Mega Man X4 for the PlayStation got like almost a perfect score. And then someone else reviewed the game for Saturn and gave it like barely above average and said, this is like, you know, and to be fair, the review was bad because he was like, why do we need 2D games in this 3D world? Blah, 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 blah. And it was, you know, just kind of a crappy opinion. But the point is, it made me realize, okay, different reviewers are going to have different opinions on things, and that's okay. Like, people were saying, oh, how come he gave Double Dragon 4 a 3 and he gave this a 2.5? And it's like, you can't really stack them up the same way, people.
So it goes. I think the right solution is to get rid of review scores.
I won't weep for them, put it that way. If we're not mature enough to handle numbers, then, okay, we're not going to work with numbers anymore.
I don't know. I think I just want the discourse to stop getting lost over a arbitrary number.
Which,
let's be honest, it's a really arbitrary number.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to quantify things like games.
It is. But let's talk about something a little happier, Nadia.
Yeah, let's talk about a 10 out of 10 game called Chrono Trigger.
Yeah.
And that deserves every 10 out of 10.
Yeah. Wow, Nadia. Wow. I have a cat who is rubbing against my microphone at the moment.
Hello, Hamish.
He is very excited, too. So I started playing Chrono Trigger. I've been in Europe the past couple weeks. I started playing Chrono Trigger, as I promised in a previous episode. And I am legitimately shocked how good it is. Like,
yep.
I mean, okay, it's one thing to like hear all the outsized praise for it. All of the people are like, oh, this game is incredible. Yeah, that's fine and all, right? Like, you hear that about a lot of games. People say that about Ocarina of Time all the dang time. And don't get me wrong, it's a brilliant game. Probably the best N64 game. Probably deserves to be in the top 25 games of all time. But, like, in some respects, I'm, like, going...
Oh, I was going to say, Ocarina of Time, I don't think I'd... I don't really have any huge desire to go back to it, but Chrono Trigger, I still pick up once in a while and play through it.
Yeah, that's my point. It was the Ocarina of Time, like, okay, yeah, but this game really feels like it came from 1990, whatever year it came out, 98.
98.
Where Chrono Trigger, how well crafted it is.
It's very timeless.
How gorgeous it is. How good the soundtrack is.
Oh, it's fantastic.
How good the battle system is. Like, outside of some, like, very minor pacing issues, this game really doesn't have many weaknesses.
No. Although, when I talking about fanboyism again, when I was in part of that BBS I talked about, there were arguments over like how terrible it was next to Final Fantasy VI, which was a stupid, stupid argument. And looking back on it, I just want to hit myself for even reading that.
I think both Final Fantasy VI and Chrono Trigger are really amazing games that you should absolutely play and enjoy. I think Chrono Trigger is better.
At least so far. Yeah, I've had that debate with myself before, and I think I would just barely have to give the edge to Chrono Trigger, because even though it does have pacing issues, I think Six's pacing issues are a little more problematic.
But the thing is, the pacing issues aren't that bad. Like, I'm playing through them right now. The future was... I think that's been my least favorite part of the game so far. But like,
well, that's even stuck before.
But people were also complaining about the whole Masamune quest for Frog.
And I never found that too bad.
I didn't find it bad at all. Like, the whole the quest to like reforge the blade and get Frog out of his funk was like that was no problem at all, because like the actual elements of the quest were really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And like, one of the things that I'm sorry I didn't get to during the Horizon Zero Dawn discussion with Katie was Horizon Zero Dawn has like is very fetch questy. Mm-hmm. In the way that it handles things. That's what she was kind of referring to when she called Aloy, like, everybody's hunting cat.
Yeah.
Where, like, in Witcher 3, like, the side quests are beautifully realized and really, like, really interesting and kind of tell their own stories in their own way, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Same with Chrono Trigger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, even though I'm spending a lot of time going through and looking for, like, a piece of rock, like, I'm going back to 65 million BC and like fighting these like reptiles who have like stolen the rock and everything, and this was part of the main quest. But my point is that this could have been a lot more boring.
Exactly. And it's not just a matter of fetching the rock from these lizard people. You learn how they have this struggle for survival going on between mammals and reptiles, and even though, okay, we know how it's going to work out ultimately, it's still really interesting to follow.
But I got as far as the Fiend Lord's Keep. And in the Fiend Lord's Keep, there is a sequence that I just adore and really hammers home to me everything that I really like about Chrono Trigger.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the entire battle with Ozzy.
I'll tell you, when I fought Ozzy as a kid, I kept attacking his shield like an idiot. I didn't realize you had to like attack the winches to get him to fall down his own trap.
Yeah, he's totally like, you're attacking the wrong one, man.
What an
but
idiot.
The whole point is, it's like, the boss battle is actually, like, the entire sequence where he's, like, setting off traps and, like, trying to stop you.
Mm-hmm.
And that would not have worked. It wouldn't have really worked in, like, a traditional turn-based RPG like Final Fantasy VI with random encounters. For one thing, it would have been a pain in the ass to keep mm-hmm. getting thrown down to the bottom of a pit.
I mean,
it was kind of annoying anyway, but it would have been even worse if it had been random encounters.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
But at the same time, like, having enemies actually on the screen, which, by the way, the sprites in that game are so good.
Aren't they awesome? Like I was saying, games like Chrono Trigger and Suikoden make me kind of really depressed how you will never see sprites like that ever again.
Oh, that's not true. There's some amazing sprites in Shovel Knight.
You got a point there. Okay, I will concede to that. But just in general, that sort of gritty jaggedness that's beautiful in its primitiveness, you don't really get that so much anymore.
My cat has some very strong opinions on this front.
As he should.
So, like, having that stuff on the screen is really, like, it just works. And it mm-hmm. makes the encounters, like, feel a lot more seamless. It kind of has the best of both worlds in terms of having enemies on the screen, but also having a traditional turn-based battle system. And I think it's great.
Yeah, it is. Actually, have you defeated Magus yet?
I have defeated Magus, yes.
So one thing I really like about his keep is just that real meshing of... It's really creepy. I mean, you do have that bit with Ozzy, which is hilarious, but it's just such a... one of the most atmospheric dungeons I've ever been in an RPG, especially when you're, like, doing the final descent
I totally agree.
Yeah. Down to Magus himself. And just, like, how mm-hmm. the music cues up as you're about to fight him. Mm-hmm. I'd still just love to go back and listen to that theme. Holy crap.
The music is really, 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 really good.
It is.
I was hanging out with a friend yesterday and singing Chrono Trigger's praises, and he's like, Mitsuda's better than Uematsu.
That's a really controversial opinion, but I can't really argue too hard against it.
But you were talking about how atmospheric the Fiend Lord's Keep is. Like the first time you roll up to the door and look up at the tower.
Yeah, and the dragon's there.
Yeah, no, that's really cool. Like, and I remember like looking at stuff like that in magazines and things, and just being kind of blown away by like the scale of it compared to what was possible in like the NES. Like, it's such a rich piece of artwork.
It is, and it was actually not to say Final Fantasy VI was a bad-looking game by any means, but that was the first game that made me realize JRPGs did not have to compromise visuals for gameplay.
Absolutely not. I would even go as far as to say that it is one of the best-looking games on the Super Nintendo,
and
really, really brings forth everything that is great about that platform.
Yes.
By 1995, there were a lot of developers, like, it was actually pretty annoying. Like, in their quest for, like, quote-unquote more realistic graphics, you were things like seeing things like digitization, which was terrible.
Oh, God, yeah. Yes.
You had the 2.5D perspective of Donkey Kong. You had a lot of developers using, like, this really annoying, like, heavy guitar riffs with the SNES sound chip that often sounded
terrible.
Mega Man
X3 was the worst for that. Oh, my God.
Yeah, exactly. And Chrono Trigger does not fall into any of those traps. And meanwhile, uses all of the Super Nintendo's various tricks. Like, now that I'm at a certain point, like, the battle system, like, a lot of the attacks just look great. Oh my
they do,
God.
Don't they? Like, the spells and the text, especially when you get into the triple text, holy crap, you're gorgeous.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it.
It's actually funny. I have a certain degree of, what's it called, synesthesia, where you kind of associate things with colors and sound.
Oh, you have that.
I do. And when I think Chrono Trigger, I just instantly get this in my head, that this rich blue and this, like, golden, just this rich blue and golden melding, and a little bit of red. I guess that represents Chrono's hair or something like that, but it's just a really pleasant thought to just think back on that game, and very, very few games do that for me.
Yeah, the colors in that game are extremely rich, though I'm sad because I'm playing it on my DS, and the upscaling is not doing that game a lot of favors, and it's kind of making me wish that I were playing it on like a traditional Super Nintendo right now.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask you, does the DS version, does that have the new translation? Not to say it's bad, just...
My understanding is that they have at least tweaked the translation a bit.
Yeah, because I noticed you're calling it the Fiend Lord's Keep, and it's like, that's not really what I call it. I call it Magus' Castle.
They called it the Fiend Lord's Keep.
Of course, so. Yeah. Does Frog have his old-timey English dialogue?
Not that I recall. Like, I don't think it's like super over the top like Dragon Quests.
Yeah, because that's how he talked in the original translation. There was like from day one, as soon as people realized that they can go on the internet and get angry about translations, there was a lot of debate back and forth about whether or not Woolsey did the right thing with Frog. I like his like really old medieval sort of dialect. He has like some pretty good lines out of it.
I'm fine with it. I would be fine with it. I don't think that's the case in this one at all.
Mm-hmm.
I would be fine with it because one of the things that I like about Chrono Trigger the most is this sense of... I love that you have people in your party come from all different times.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So I love that you have, you know, you're like your robot from the future and like your Stone Age lady, and you have, well... like a fairy tale frog, like warrior, knight, who's been turned into a frog or something.
That actually reminds me. Have you ever read Clan of the Cave Bear?
No.
So you don't know about Ayla's, her namesake then, do you?
No.
There's a, I can't remember the name of the author, but Clan of the Cave Bear. It's like a whole series about a cave woman named Ayla. So that's where she comes from. They're actually, the first book I'm thinking of, Clan of the Cave Bear, is fantastic. You should read it sometime if you have a chance. The rest of them are mostly porn. I don't want to say outright porn, but they're very much the sort of like erotica you find in your mother's bookshelf, and you pick it up and you read it like, whoa, I shouldn't be reading this. But it's funny because my mom was watching me play the game one day, and she's like, why did they name her Ayla? It's like, wait a minute, I know that. So that was kind of funny.
I don't know like how much more I can like sit here and go, yep, Chrono Trigger's amazing.
Well, it's funny because I'm actually...
that has been known since 1995.
Well, you haven't even gotten... to, God, the best parts of the game, as far as I'm concerned, as far as many people are concerned, like God's Zeal and the Ocean Palace, and I'm really looking forward to it. This is kind of like my Persona 4 report for me. I want to hear all about your Chrono Trigger adventures. Unfortunately, it'll probably be a little shorter. It's not a very long game, but I don't know if you want to go for all the endings. You should.
I'm fine with that. I am fine with it being not that long because, well, first of all, I have a whole mess of games coming up, including Zelda, as well as, well, Persona 5 is coming up not before coming. Too long, and I have a few others, so I'm kind of glad that I'm not going to be, like, roped into playing this game for a very, very long time.
Yeah, and New Game Plus really makes it easy to go through the games and get all the endings. It won't take you too long.
Oh, last thing I want to point out, I really like the boss battles so far. I think that they are so well constructed, and that really speaks to the strength of the battle system.
Mm-hmm. And, again, I can't even bring up some of the really awesome bosses you'll be going up against, but yeah, they're all really just big, gorgeous sprites, really memorable boss music. You can always tell when like you're up against a real badass boss because it has that really urgent sort of boss music you got when you're fighting Masamune.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, initially it seems like it's not going to be that deep, but then stuff like when you're fighting Magus, and he... toward the end of the battle, he starts charging up to use like his super duper attack.
Yeah.
And like that is your moment when he's charging up to, because like his defenses fall to like go all in with all of your attacks. But you also have to be aware that you're going to have to heal and like fast.
Yeah. And it's not like he stops attacking you. He still goes after you when he's charging up. And he does the barrier changes too.
He does the barrier changes, which is... like super tricky because like I was waiting for, see, I was using Frog, Marla, Marl, I don't know, M-A-R-L-E.
Her name's Princess Nadia.
Princess Nadia. Okay. Princess Nadia. And the main character, whom I named Cat. And like, so as a result, like I had, see, Frog and Princess Nadia have a really strong, water and ice attack that will like fry most of the screen, so I was like leaning on that really heavily for quite a while. But then when I was fighting the boss, like there was a point like I was waiting patiently for the barrier, for Magus's barrier to turn to water so that I could do a substantial amount of damage, so that aspect was really tricky with waiting for the right barrier to show up, and then like basically like going, nope, not the right one, switch. But every time you switched it, like he would do pretty nasty attack. There's a lot of every battle is complex and interesting, and never just like hack slash slash dead, spam ultima, whatever.
No, in fact, one of my favorite boss fights is well, it's coming up, but it's very much the same thing where you cannot spam the bad guy, and if you'd even try to just hack away at him, you're gonna die. There's nothing to it. But you're in for some good times.
I am in for some good times. I'm totally gonna play some more.
You should.
And maybe I'll write some more about it on the site. Even though I like that this is basically catnip for a community.
Yeah. There's a reason. You can understand now why people love talking about Chrono Trigger all these years later. It's just such a perfect... I think the team was perfect, too. Just like Toriyama, Sakaguchi. It's just wonderful.
It's fun to go back. It's fun to discover a game that everybody really loved from back in the day. And discover that not only is it every bit as good that as everybody is saying, that it just really holds up over these years, that you don't have to use your imagination, you don't have to put it into context and go,
exactly,
yeah, this was amazing in 1995. No, you can go, no, this is really amazing now. Holy crap, like it's so well crafted. Jesus.
Have you played Chrono Cross?
I have played some Chrono Cross. I've gotten pretty far in it, actually.
Yeah, that's a game you can appreciate on its own merits. You don't really have to have Chrono Trigger under your belt to play it. I think it's a great game on its own, not so great as a Chrono Trigger sequel, but I guess that's a discussion for another time.
Indeed. And that another time will have to happen next week, because this is the end of our episode. Axe of the Blood God is a US Gamer podcast. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, that one. Yes, that SoundCloud, one. Wherever our RPG podcasts are sold, or just podcasts in general. Follow us on Twitter. I'm at @_catbot. Nadia is at Nadia Oxford, and Katie is at YUME Katie. You make Katie. I think that might be it.
I think so.
You should go follow her and be nice to her, because she's had a rough week. Bad gamers.
Naughty.
Well, we actually have a lot to cover in general, because next week Torment Tides of Numenera is coming out in the same day as Horizon Zero Dawn, as it happens. And we got Rowan Kaiser reviewing that one for us, and he will be on the show, I think maybe next week, to talk about it. We recently just also posted a Vagrant Story localization thing.
We did. It's fantastic.
Interview. It's really fantastic. It's by John Learned, who also did a long one about Final Fantasy XII with Alexander O. Smith. And you should go check it out on the site. You should go spread its praises on like Reddit and like NeoGAF and stuff, because I feel like not enough people have seen this thing. And it's such a really well done, like, walkthrough essentially of how a game gets translated.
Yeah, especially back then when things were very different in the industry.
Yeah, it has a really good kind of like point by point breakdown of like how the Vagrant Story script kind of became the way that it did.
Yes.
Yeah, so you should go check it out. It's on the main page. I will have John Learned on next week to talk about it. I'm going to have Steve Tramer on next week. It's going to end up being like a triple length episode.
Wow, guest heavy.
Yeah, because next week is GDC, and Tramer is going to be in town. We're going to do our now annual, like, let's get together and like talk about RPGs over beers, and it's going to be great. I'm going to have Rowan. I'm going to have John Learned. My God, the Switch is coming out that day. It's going to be freaking bonkers. My God, next week is going to be insane. But then the week after that, we'll have our big Zelda Mega Cast the week after. So you'll have a little bit of time to play some Zelda before we actually talk about it.
Which is nice.
That is nice, because that is a big game. I made Mike Williams like go away.
She did. I'm basically filling in for Mike this week.
Yeah, I said, Mike, go away and play Zelda, and also do this and play Switch, and just do everything that you can about this system. Right. So we'll be back next week with what is probably going to be like a 2.5 hour podcast. We are back, baby. Sorry about the hiatus, but we are locked in and ready to go. And of course, if you have anything that you want to share with us, drop me a line at cat.bailey@usgamer.net, and we may read your comments on the show. But until then, for Nadia, Katie, and myself, we'll be back again with the same wonderful RPG discussions as always. We'll see you then. Until then, happy adventuring.